Hello, everyone. My name is Taylor.
And I'm Kelly.
And we are the co-hosts of Jumping Bomb Audio, the number one show all about the world of Joshi Pro Wrestling. Episodes drop every other Monday, where we discuss the biggest Joshi news, review shows, and preview the hottest upcoming Joshi action.
So whether you're a new fan or an old fan, we've got something here for you at Jumping Bomb Audio.
Check us out on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome to another episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. I'm your host, Tyler Fornes, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Fred Moreland. And Fred, how do you feel about gathering up a few $1 billion to buy WWE?
You know, I left my wallet up downstairs, and I'm sure I have at least 120. So, Vince McMahon, I formally offer to purchase WWE and all of its subsidiaries, all of its intellectual property, and all of its goods for $20. I look forward to your response. Thank you.
Insert Patrick Star meme. I have $3.
Tyler, please send that voice clip to Stanford for me, and I'll let you know what happens.
Sounds good. No, but I think it's creates a very interesting discussion talking about the potential sale of WWE. And as we know, a bunch of jabronis on wrestling Twitter decided to report that the Saudis were officially buying the company, and we found out that while they have not come anywhere close to buying the company, they are interested among multiple sources. And one of those that is interested in buying the company is Tony and Shad Khan. Now, they are very, very rich, but we are not talking about a normal type of rich. We're talking about uber rich. We're talking about David Tepper buying the Carolina Panthers for $5 billion in straight cash. That they're not that kind of rich. They are capital rich, not cash rich in right. this sense. And it's something that they would have to either partner with other investors or liquidate some of their assets in order to become cash rich enough to buy World Wrestling Entertainment. I think it's very interesting that the Khans want to buy World Wrestling Entertainment, but I also think it's smart for anybody in the wrestling business that could potentially have enough cash to want to look into buying World Wrestling Entertainment, because it is the global leader as far as distribution and just gross sales and profit in the industry. It would be a massive benefit for literally anybody in wrestling to own World Wrestling Entertainment, except for maybe Brett Lauderdale. And it would be good to see WWE be good again. And I think the interesting thing about the Khans being interested, I want to throw this at you. I wonder if they're not even interested in buying World Wrestling Entertainment's intellectual property, but rather all the intellectual property and wrestling history that World Wrestling Entertainment knows to potentially make their own streaming service, like Mid-South, Texas, Florida, all the indies that were on the old WWE network that were just hidden gems for all of us, and something that Tony Khan really loves, wrestling history. Being able to utilize that and actually have a space to show it unclipped, I think would be a tremendous asset to wrestling. And I wonder if that might be the end goal for their explorations with buying World Wrestling Entertainment, because I feel like that would be incredibly feasible. Maybe let's throw out an arbitrary number. Maybe they pay $100 million to get the entire back catalog of non-WWE wrestling that's on the network. Feels like that could be, one, worth the money, and two, something that is incredibly feasible for what the cash flow is for the Khan family.
Yeah, that's something. There's a lot to consider here. So basically, first of all, is money. Shad Khan looks like he has a net worth of about $11 billion, which is a large number, several zeros after that 11. But just for comparison, the Saudi public investment fund has ranked, or it appears to have, per this ArabNews.com article, a total amount of $620 billion, which is a much larger number. So, you know, if the cons are serious about trying to buy this, they would definitely, I think, have to team up with some people they would be the majority owners, and they'd have some minority owners coming along for the ride, which is a viable option. Now, the other thing to consider here is the cons would definitely have, and any minority owners would definitely be driven to get a profit off this. And that's not so much a concern with the Saudi investment fund, I wouldn't think. They're doing basically sports washing using WWE. And that's been the big part of their deal ever since it started, with them paying them $50 million a show to essentially do propaganda on behalf of the country. And so with that, they, you know, if they buy this to continue doing even more sports washing, the thing with it is that there's less of a motivation for profit because they're buying it for this explicit purpose. And as such, you know, maybe they don't care so much about profit if they have purchased it and taken it private. They don't have a real duty to shareholders like you do with a public corporation. So they can just say, all right, we're taking a haircut on this per annual, but, you know, it's our attempt to make ourselves look more palatable to people who don't like us. As for purchasing the tape library, I wouldn't really hold my breath on that. There's a possibility that they could have talks with whoever ends up purchasing it down the road as a separate transaction, but this doesn't seem like it's going to be a let's break up WWE and sell off parts as part of this deal. I think it's just going to be, here's the block, it's been sold, Vince stays in power because that's all he cares about, and other than the money, obviously, but he gets to keep running the business, and you know, that is what's going to keep him happy. And am I ruling out the cons buying it? No. I just don't think it's going to be the most likely outcome. One other thing that I've seen floated around, and I've been talking so long, I forget if you said this now, Tyler, but another thing that's been floated is that perhaps the cons are showing interest so that they can look at the secret WWE books that will reveal all their secrets to them. And I'm not sure that's really a thing that would happen in this circumstance. They're a publicly traded company, and so a bunch of their information is already out in the open. It's just that it's all glommed together. Like, for example, they hide the Saudi payment in a certain byline on their report, or not byline, but an item line on their financial reports, and fold it in with other things. But it's largely the Saudi money at that line. The thing with that is, I'm not sure how much information they get the right to look at, if they are even serious buyers, if they're even trying to pose as serious buyers just so they can look at those books. So I'm not sure how much of a real likelihood that's a game they're playing there is. But I don't know. It's a very interesting circumstance. I think it'd be great if Tony Khan was able to purchase like the Dragon Gate USA and Evolve libraries and all the old territory libraries. I just would not really imagine that happening at all. But
yeah, I think one thing that is really interesting about the idea of the cons actually looking at the books, for being that it's a publicly traded company, the one interesting thing for me here, Fred, is I think if you look at the books, you get to see all the salaries of all the wrestlers and then be able to compare them to what you are paying the men and women on your roster, and be able to offer smarter contracts. And I think when you talk about the books, those are the numbers that are the most interesting, because I think with a publicly traded company, you're going to have, hey, there's going to be an X number for wrestler salaries on the books, but they may not actually go into excruciating detail being like, hey, we're paying Roman Reigns X amount of money. We're paying like, NXT wrestler Cora Jade X amount of money, and then everybody in between. I don't think that they're doing that as far as their publicly traded information. So that would be one area where Tony Khan could get the leg up, and he could understand, oh, I lost out to WWE on signing X wrestler, Bronson Reed. Because I don't know for sure, but I would guess that Tony Khan would have interest in bringing in the former Jonah. Because, I mean, look at him. He kicks ass. So he'd be like, okay, let's say Jonah's being paid by WWE $1 million. Well, I offered him, let's throw out an arbitrary number again, say $750. Then you could really start to understand, hey, how am I valuing these guys versus how is WWE valuing them? And then I can make more competitive offers with X, Y, Z, yada, yada, bing, bang. I think that is where Tony Khan can start to gain the advantage, especially if, let's say, WWE sells to a conglomerate corporation. Let's say they sell to Comcast, just throwing another company out there. Comcast has experience in the wrestling business by airing WWE programming on both USA and NBC. And then the occasional sci-fi when, you know, other sports get in the way. Because of that, they have like an, it's like getting an invitation to a birthday party, but you've never planned a birthday party. That's kind of where Comcast is in the wrestling business. They're involved, but they aren't involved. And if they were to purchase it, it's going to be similar to what happened at the end of WCW. You're going to have executives that are involved in wrestling that have probably never been involved in wrestling before, but they understand the television side of it. How are they going to deal with contracts? How are they going to deal with merchandise, ticket sales, booking venues? Like, those elements of it, I think, are very intriguing. And it's kind of all a roundabout way of saying that I think it could be beneficial for Tony Khan to look at all that stuff. And it could be a huge benefit if one of those companies buys it and Vince McMahon doesn't stay in charge, because they don't necessarily know what they're doing with the wrestling business.
Yeah. First of all, I don't know that they really need a peek in the books to know what people are being paid, though, because they can. I think that's pretty well, like, there's, you know, Meltzer has talked about like some numbers before. I think there's enough information out there where if you dig into it, you may not know down to like the penny, but you'll have at least a rough idea of like, okay, once you make the main roster, I think Meltzer has said you're making $250,000. And, you know, there's several people on the main roster making at least seven figures. And I think that's, I don't know what benefit Khan really gets from, you know, like, just, I mean, obviously, if you can, you look, that's one thing. But I don't know that it's going to be some big benefit for him to go, oh, Randy Orton, I thought he was getting paid $1 million a year, but he's actually getting paid 1.1. I mean, I just don't know that's like really going to change anything. As for the wrestling executive, I mean, the TV executives over the wrestling company, I honestly believe that there's no way the sale is going to be completed without Vince McMahon going along on top for the ride. And the way Vince McMahon is looked at by investors currently, and I would have to assume this would carry over to whoever is the person, you know, the buyer and their executives, is going to be looked at as like the one guy who understands professional wrestling. And so he'll be kept long in charge for as long as he can do it and doesn't piss anyone off and doesn't send WWE into a flaming crater of a hole, which, you know, I mean, the booking can get bad sometimes with him. The more interesting thing, I think, is consider that Vince is, what is he, 76? Is that right? I mean,
he's old.
Yes, he looked rough at WrestleMania this year. He is currently 77. So you got a 77-year-old in charge of the business. You know, how long is that going to last? Because of health, because of mental stability, because of, you know, maybe the network looks at it after, like Comcast buys it. After a year or two, they may be like, you know, we're not super happy with these numbers. They could be better. We're going to have to make a change. Are they going to just let Vince stick around in charge of everything, which I presume is what's going to happen when he comes in? Or are they going to make a change? And if so, who at that point? Because, you know, I guess there's like Paul Heyman you could go to, but there's Triple H, but like I just have a feeling that he's going to be booted in the next couple weeks, or maybe after the sale is complete. But I just don't think he's long for the WWE corporate world.
No, I don't think he is either. And this whole thing is obviously going to continue to give us new information. It's going to present different options. And I think having discussions and figuring out, hey, what is this this company going to do and who is it going to end up being sold to? I'm going to be honest. It's going to be one of the more fun things for us to track over the next however long, because it's a fascinating topic, but we
it just is don't it's very interesting. It's the biggest news story in literally 20 years. It's bigger than Vince resigning last year, just because it's not just his power play back into the company and taking over and enforcing his will on it again. Boy, there's a distasteful joke in there somewhere. But also, you know, just the fact that they're selling this company that has been basically, you know, family owned for decades, and they're going to sell it off for, 10 figures, maybe 11. My prediction, this is just a guess. I don't have any inside information. And frankly, your favorite wrestling reporter right now probably doesn't either at this point. but my prediction is that they're going to get sold to the Saudi investment fund. I think they're just going to be motivated to spend more money than anyone else. And my presumption is that when it comes down to this decision, it's going to be who puts the most money on the table. And Saudi, the investment fund does not have to, it does not have as much of a profit motivation as these the publicly traded companies do. The only group that I could possibly compare it to would be the Khans, because they would, I would assume, also be purchasing it and taking it private, but they have a fraction of the money that the investment fund has, like a hundredth, literally, roughly. You know, it's top of the head math. So I just don't foresee them like ponying up the same number of billions for this company. Because it's not, you know, when you're rich, your money is not like kept in a Scrooge McDuck vault and you just fling the door open and go, all right, get me $7 billion of gold coins out of my money vault. you sell some stuff, then you cut a check, very expensive check. So I just don't think that the Khans can pull it off. But, you know, monopolies are bad for wrestling. And if the Khans did purchase it, it'd be a... Short, you know, it'd be a monopoly again, just like it was before AEW was formed. But, you know, for a couple months, it'd be a pretty funny monopoly. I will at least give it credit for that.
No, oh, it would
cat
be
running.
Oh, the Hungy cat has made his appearance as Odie.
Done the run in.
Odie, it does not have to do the run in. He is sleeping on my feet right now as we record the show. And I am very excited to continue to talk about that one Odie who is going to get neutered on Monday, RIP his balls. But I'm very excited to continue talking about AEW. So we're going to move on. Dallas, Texas Magazine interviewed Sting recently, and Sting said he's retiring this year. I don't know how much I buy it, and I did not read the article, Fred, and I'm wondering if you have more context on it. Is this just from in-ring, or is this him removing himself permanently from the wrestling business and not even being on TV anymore?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have not read the magazine. I just saw the note about it in the Observer. I have it open right now. I don't outright see it. Yeah, I don't think it's like a formal announcement, but yeah, I don't see anything specifically when I just do a control F for retire on this article indicating that he's guaranteeing a retirement by the end of the year, but yeah.
Hey, thank God Tony Khan exists, because we got damn near 3.5 more years. For 4 years out of Sting in professional wrestling. And that is an incredible, incredible blessing.
Yeah. And you know, it's gone a lot better than the 2015 run he's had. And which was just kind of, the way that Triple H match. It's one of the funniest ones to go back to from WrestleMania 31, I think it was, where, you know, they just had a normal ass feud where Sting was the crusading hero against the big heel Triple H, and then the match was entirely rehashing the Monday Night Wars for the 5 millionth time, just so they could show that once and for all, Vince McMahon won, in case you forgot. What a time to be alive. Anyways, I digress. Yeah, I don't know if he is retiring or not specifically, but that is the report from Dave recapping this article that I have not read yet.
Hey, you know what? I remember that match from WrestleMania 31, and in real time, as just a mark, that was fun as hell.
Oh, it was a fun match. I mean, all the run-ins were done really well and everything, but it, once you like think critically at all about the finish for a second, you're like, what the hell? You know, because there was no stakes on the line. There was no bell. There was no reason Sting should not have won to the heel. And then Triple H cheated the entire match and they shook hands afterwards. You know, true respect.
It was just Vince laying his dick on the table and being like, yeah. Hey, I won, you lost. Like, that's really all that was. And just an unfortunate way for Sting to have his first match go. And I wonder if there was any plans of doing a match the next year, because I don't remember if there was any reporting on that at the time, because 6 months later, Sting broke his neck on a buckle bomb against Seth Rollins in a WWE title match. And bada bing, bada boom, you all of a sudden, Sting's done. And he ended up healing up and obviously coming back to AEW, but there was more meat on the bone with his WWE run. And I wonder if there was any future plans for him outside of, you know, just keeping Seth Rollins away from actual main roster, like everyday talent.
Yeah. Sting has always wanted to work Undertaker, which has never happened and never will, unfortunately. But I will just, the first couple results when you search Sting WrestleMania 32 are two articles from Bleacher Report about how Undertaker versus Sting at Mania 32 shouldn't happen. So Ryan Dilbert is not up for this shit.
Yeah, I guess not. But we won't bury Ryan too much. He writes for the network on occasion. He's a good person.
Oh, I don't have any beef with him. I was just thought it was funny that, like, especially when I thought the first article was like 2 days later, it was like it should happen, but no, it was just also don't do it. So
yeah. More news. Tony Khan says house shows are on the way in an interview with In the Zone. There was no timeline given, but I think we all saw this coming. When they hired Jeff Jarrett as I don't know what the exact title was, but it was something along the lines of a live events coordinator.
I think that's right. I think that's actually what it was.
And you know what? I'm not all for like doing house show loops and stuff, but I'll tell you, if you continue to do live rampages and hey, we're going to do a Friday night rampage. Oh, and then we're going to do a Saturday house show nearby. I think that's tremendous. Get these young guys reps, get Top Flight, Jade Cargill, get them doing a loop, get them doing consistent matches. Plus, with how AEW is growing in popularity, and obviously live events aren't necessarily doing the greatest right now, but if you get live events and like WWE had A-list, B-list, and C-list towns, hit up some of these smaller towns. Like, they're coming to you, Fred, here shortly in Lexington, Kentucky.
That is correct.
That's not an A-list town, but they're going to an A-list. They're going to an A-list arena in Rupp Arena, one of the biggest arenas in the United States. Like, go to towns that you normally wouldn't hit. Go to Cheyenne, Wyoming. Go to Idaho. And
yeah, like, and I have this theory that you hit these smaller markets and they aren't like right on top of the bigger markets. Mm-hmm. You'll draw very well, especially the first time, because we've definitely seen like a first go round boost to AEW attendance whenever they go to a market the first time. And I have no reason to think that, like, you know, Billings, Montana would not be the same, you know. Now, I do wonder, I'm going to float a possibility of what this could be. You know, there's a possibility that they'll do, like, major or, like, not quite major cities, you know, as part of the house show thing. But I also wonder if they would consider doing something like the NXT house loop. Where it's a concentrated area, just, you know, they go up to around Atlanta, they go down to where the hell in Florida,
Like a real territory.
Yeah, like an actual territory with their smaller, you know, with their on the up kind of people. You know, they're not putting like Darby Allin in these matches or the Bucks or whoever, but like they're setting Jade Cargill and Private Party and Top Flight and, you know,
the Nightmare Factory.
Nightmare Factory, yeah. The Gun Club, all these other like younger acts that could really use some more experience to like finalize what they are and to improve the games. I just wonder if that's, you know, a possibility that's on the table with them or not.
I think that'd be a great idea. And I don't, you could do a loop. You could do like, hey, we're just going to do a second show in a town within a couple hours. And it doesn't have to be a tremendous set. You don't have to do a full AEW set. Have like, do you remember the G1 show in Dallas where it was like a super basic set with like one entrance? Do that. It doesn't have to be fancy. Like just
and like another thing, like WWE runs Corbin, Kentucky, which is a small town and like right along the border between Kentucky and Tennessee, about 2 hours south of Lexington. It has a population under 10,000. You know, I mean, they run it every year because I guess they get enough attendance from it. Just because a town's not big doesn't mean you can't run there. And so, you know, I'm kind of hopeful that they're not just going to be like, oh, we're running a house show in New York in February. And then in June, we're going to Los Angeles and then August, Houston. And those are our house shows. Like this needs to be a learning opportunity because you have a lot of talent on your roster that needs more experience. You know, you could have Ricky Starks working actual main events night in, night out. And that could give him a lot of experience. You know, you could just go up and down the card. Like Hook could be working as a main eventer. You could be trying out different tag teams. You could have like Hook work a little heel and see how that works out, or Jack Perry work a little heel, or whoever, you know, just kind of try out different things. And that would be the benefit from house shows, because it's not going to be a financial benefit. You know, WWE does not make money off of their house shows. And I don't think that, you know, if AEW runs like a WWE style circuit, they're not going to, I would be surprised if they break even. Just because it's only ticket sales and merch, and when you consider all the travel costs and the expenditures of putting up the sets and traveling with that and everything, you know, they'd probably be well to get a push off that financially. But another thing is that, you know, you cannot get this kind of experience in the other way. And I've been a proponent for a while of AEW using their money to develop the next generation of stars. Like another idea I've had is like to sign 5 pretty high level collegiate athletes to $100,000 a year contracts, just to like give them an incentive to go there instead of like a minor league sport, and give them a shot at wrestling. And if it doesn't work out after 6 months or a year, you can cut bait and then cast, you know, the next year.
I think that's a great idea. Just a way to continue to get these guys more reps, and then the more reps they get, the better they are. And you don't have to use a lot of television time with some of these people too. And I think that can be a really big, big thing. Plus you could get guys on rotating house show loops. Like, hey, Moxley, we need you to do 1 month. And for 1 month, he'll do Dynamite, Rampage in the house show. And then he'll get like 3-4 months off. And then, oh, hey, let's say January, it's Moxley. February, it's the Elite. And they're doing a house show loop with trios matches. Maybe it's with Death Triangle, obviously being like a year. But
yeah,
do a house show loop, and that's the main event. 4 straight matches. And then, oh, March comes around. Hey, Darby Allin. There you go. April, Hangman Page. Like, you can make this work, and you can utilize your big stars, but you don't have to utilize all of them. This roster is deep enough where you can maneuver, you can add different individuals, you can sub them in and out, and you don't have guys completely worn out, and you're not asking a ton of them. You're asking them, hey, you're going to do Rampage each, like they're going to continue doing live Rampages. You do Rampage this night, the next night, we're going to go to a town 2.5 hours away, and you're going to do a house show, and then you're going to fly home. And I think that can be a very successful way to, one, continue to get these guys ring time. 2, make more money. 3, expose your product to even more people. Mm-hmm. Because on a Saturday night, hey, we've got like the whole AEW thing when Dynamite first started, tickets starting at $20. Like, you can do house shows, tickets starting at $20. Mm-hmm. And you can sell your ringside seats and your like first few rows for a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. You can sell your box suites. But hey, you want to sit in the last few rows? We'll give you $20 seats. Hell yeah. Yeah. Get people in the building and let them watch. And you know what? You may take a little bit of a financial hit, but I think over time, the amount of reps you're going to give these young people, because you can just be like, hey, here's 15 minutes. Do whatever the hell you want. This is the finish. Hell yeah. Let these guys call shit in the ring. If it's bad, who cares?
Exactly. And it's a house show.
Yeah. And then you know what? If the opener sucks because they botched a few things, guess what? The main event is John Moxley versus Miro.
Yeah.
That's going to kick ass. Like, you can make things work. And I think that could be a net benefit. And because the travel would only be a couple hours and you're using a minimal set, you're not exactly asking a lot financially from AEW either. You're going to rent the building. You're going to have a minimal travel cost because everybody's already going to be there. And you're not going to have a massive set. It's going to be a super basic production. Like, WWE house shows are super basic productions, unless it's like an MSG house show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can really do a number and make this great. And I really hope that with the addition of Jeff Jarrett and this kind of being his calling card, he learns from all the failures of TNA and tries to incorporate that and make this a real success.
Yeah, hopefully. And, you know, I just think it's a great opportunity that they should be taking. It could really benefit their company long term. And they have the money where they can afford to invest this. You know, again, yeah, and there's lots you can do with it. Like, you're going to a town, well, just, you know, pair up and as part of it, do some outreach with your community service group there. You know, you can do something with the radio stations. You can do all these things that, like, hyper focus marketing on the small town and can help things out.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm very intrigued to see how house shows look. But they're not coming anytime soon. And speaking of a quasi house show, the Jericho Appreciation Society appeared at the Battle of Los Angeles, defeating Jonathan Gresham, Kevin Blackwood, Michael Oku, Player Uno, and SB Kento in a 5-on-5 tag match. This was a really, really cool spot because, one, you have Chris Jericho just being Chris Jericho, showing up at Bola, like, just giving the fans a little bit of something extra without really doing anything. Like, this was just really cool. Obviously, you had like Chris Jericho against SB Kento. I think I want to see that because I think
Ultimo Dragon trainee, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. And then the biggest news out of Bola, Speedball Mike Bailey ended up winning the tournament. He beat Konosuke Takeshita in the final, but AEW is there with the camera crew and with Don Callis scouting Takeshita. So we've kind of opined a little bit about Callis moving on from Kenny Omega because I just think the Elite are going to be baby faces for a while, and Callis doesn't necessarily fit that mold, but you can utilize Callis in a huge way to boost the profile of somebody else. And I think Takeshita could be the perfect foil for him to help rise his level in AEW because the wrestling we know is already there. It's about bringing the whole package there. Callis could be the missing piece.
It could be. And there's a lot you could do here. Storyline with Callis as the heel and Takeshita as the baby face kind of being misled for a while. You have the connection between Omega and Takeshita where they've both worked in DDT. And I think they've worked opposite each other once in a big match there. I think it was just once. But you could definitely do a line there between those two and use that as a basis of a storyline. You know, I think they're definitely working on setting something up for Takeshita. And I think we may see like the first proper steps of that in the near future, next couple weeks. But yeah, I mean, they have to know what they have with Takeshita. It's just a matter of finding the right spot to use them in. And I have confidence that they're going to do that relatively soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Frankie Kazarian has signed with Impact. And I thought this was really cool. Something that was shared earlier today in our office Slack. I'm going to pull that up and I'm going to read it. Essentially, it was last night, so I got to scroll back a little bit. But basically, this is from Mike Johnson. Frankie Kazarian announced during Impact Wrestling's Hard to Kill that he signed a new long-term contract with the promotion. During the promo, Kazarian stated that after wrestling for Impact, he had decided to remain, complacent and be with people he thought were his friends or push himself, and he chose to push himself. The word backstage at the pay-per-view is that Kazarian pretty much told the truth about what happened. We are told after his 40-plus minute match with Josh Alexander, Kazarian asked to be released, and it was granted. We are told it was completely amicable situation based around Kazarian wanting to push himself harder as he's getting close to the latter point of his career, and that in Impact, he'd have a chance to be more in the mix, that he'd likely be given the opportunity to do so in AEW, given how massive the company's roster is. We are told Kazarian, quote, did business the right way, unquote, and will be welcomed back into their locker room anytime, but going forward, he's with Impact. This is great for everybody. Kazarian was doing 10% of jack shit with AEW, and while he's an original, and he did some really cool stuff with the company, I'm really excited to see his Impact work because he wants to wrestle and he's given opportunities to do so.
Yeah, and he's had a ton of good matches in Impact this year. He had that world title match on one of their not quite pay-per-views against Josh Alexander. Had a really good Impact match with Chris Sabin back in June, and back in October had a very good match with Mike Bailey where he won the X Division Championship in October. Yeah, Kazarian, I think, fits in really well with what Impact is doing right now. I hope he's getting paid pretty well. But yeah, this feels like creatively, at least, a fantastic move for him. He already fits in really well in that roster. He's a great worker. He has the legacy there as like coming in so early in the company's history and being that through line to modern day Impact, which is always nice to have. And, it's cool. I'm happy for him.
Yeah, I am too, because Kazarian circa like 2009 was one of my favorites to watch in the ring, just doing all kinds of fun stuff. Speaking of contracts, though, Fightful reports Jay White's contract is coming due. Meltzer said that Jay White was under contract for 7 more years back in 2018. That means that he was about 2 years off, but that also doesn't necessarily mean that this was a 7-year contract, but there was an option, an opt-out, after certain points. And it's very common to see that in a lot of different sports where you can have an opt-out after a certain amount of time because, hey, things change. And an opt-out after 5 years makes a ton of sense. So Meltzer could have still been right, even though his contract is coming due. And I think Jay White is bound for America. We've heard a lot of rumors that he wants to be here. He lives in Tampa, Florida, like a lot of professional wrestlers do. I don't know if he'd go to AEW or if he'd go to WWE, but I think he would be tremendously successful in American television wrestling because of what his style is, how he's an incredible promo, and I think his style of wrestling would translates a lot better to the television style than it does with kind of the freeform style of New Japan.
God, it feels like it's the third straight year of the Jay White's a free agent, where could he go? Story dominating the news in January. And frankly, I just hope that we don't have to deal with that again. It's a little tiring. We'll see what he does if this is actual free agency, because he does have a Loser Leaves Town match coming up with Hikuleo. And of course, there's also been reports recently that Hikuleo is getting interest from WWE and that they might pick him up. So the question is, who is actually leaving the company? And, you know, which of these is just... Because I presume that, you know, one of these guys is sticking with New Japan for at least another year, and that this part of these stories are storylines that, you know, is getting fed to Fightful or whoever else. We'll see. Now, I understand in theory how Jay White feels like he could be a great TV, American TV wrestling guy. I will say that his time and Impact last year was very mediocre, I thought. It was really disappointing compared to the heights he's reached in New Japan. So, I don't know, man. I mean, I'd love to say I'm hyped up for this, but, it's not a guarantee. I mean, he's good enough where he should succeed, but there's the question of, you know, once he gets there, if everything's going to go well, whether it be WWE or AEW. If he stays in New Japan, we know what he's going to be, which is an upper card guy that has preferably 25 or 30 minute match is his preference, I'm sure. With a always a really cool finishing sequence. But
oh yeah. I also don't think it was a mistake that the Blade Runner was kicked out of for only the second time, and that ended up being Kazuchika Okada in their main event at Wrestle Kingdom 17. To me, that's even more of a signal that he's going to leave the company, because they left that move unprotected when they didn't have to. They could have protected it, and they let Okada kick out of it. Obviously, Ibushi kicked out of it for the first time. I believe it was the double gold dash where Ibushi ended up beating Jay White. And they could have avoided that, but they didn't. And I think that's, to me, it's just another sign that he's leaving.
Yeah. If I had to guess, I would guess Jay White's leaving. But, you know, I don't have any useful information. I'm just guessing here. You know, I don't know anyone. I once DM'd Ian Riccoboni to ask about basketball cards, I think.
Rich will love that story.
My scoops.
Yeah. Continuing on with the news, CM Punk has been removed from the Fight Forever cover. He responded to MJF's Instagram post with his name taped over Punk's on PWI Award. And Punk said, maybe you should tape over the ratings too. Look, it's not AEW's fault people are watching less TV overall. They are consistently in the top five. And hey, listen, Punk, that you blew all of this yourself by being a fucking asshole and deciding to go scorched earth at a company press conference. This is your fault. Shut up. Like, obviously it makes sense he's removed from the Fight Forever cover, but it's one more step to show that he's probably not coming back anytime soon.
Maybe. I wouldn't read too much into this. I think it's just him. It could very easily, I should say, just be him screwing around on social media. That doesn't matter. You know, when it comes down to it, it's money that talks. If he can be happy enough there, and if the elite can be happy enough there with him there, and everybody can, you know, just be happy together, I would not be shocked if they come back together to work again in the future. Is that likely to happen? Honestly, I'd have to say it's like a 50-50 proposition at this point in time to me. I think everyone involved to some extent can hold a grudge, and it's not just the elite. I think there's a lot of people in the locker room that would be very happy if CM Punk never showed up again. If I recall what Joe Lanza said about the subject before, from his understanding of things, it's the veterans that may have worked with Punk before that are especially tired of him, while the younger members of the locker room just kind of want him around so that it can benefit everyone. But it's just very silly at this point. It's we get these little blasts of information and people perk up because they think it's a return of a story, and it's, you know, like, not really. It doesn't really affect anything going forward, I don't think.
Yeah, it is what it is. Ring of Honor Super Card of Honor will continue to happen over WrestleMania weekend, at least in the year of 2023. That will be on March 31st in Los Angeles. And the interesting word from Tony Khan, they will be working with international companies. Now, does that mean that they will be continuing to bring in some AAA talent, which they have done so in the past? Obviously, you've had Roosh and Dragon Lee be huge proponents and elements in Ring of Honor over the past few years. Could that also mean New Japan? We know New Japan Strong is going to be folding and becoming something different here moving forward. Is that going to be because the relationship has strengthened with Ring of Honor, where it's going to kind of be merge and be almost like a super show? There's so many different elements to this, but I think it was very notable that he said working with international companies, and I'm very curious to see how that ends up.
Yeah, I mean, it's very intriguing. Will it be some people coming over from DDT? I mean, they have so many connections at this point that you could say, I mean, CMLL would be a possibility if they don't have anyone from AAA on the show because of the connection via New Japan. And there's reports that, at least for now, AEW and AAA are not actively working together. Could it be Stardom? Or Tokyo Joshi Pro, or smaller Joshi companies? Will we get, like, Ryo Mizunami back again? Will we get some, you know, Vaney? I'd love to see Vaney back. I think she's a fantastic, absolutely top tier wrestler. Who I barely saw any of last year. I'm gonna have to actively hunt out her stuff. But she's a great talent. You know, they had some really great workers in that the women's the Japanese side of the women's eliminator. God, I think it's 2 years ago now. So hopefully, you know, I think that they could really do some cool stuff. And if they were able to turn this into like a international all-star game, you know, I think that'd be a really awesome experience. But, you know, like ROH versus the world or something. But we'll see. Fingers crossed that it's, you know, cool. But, you know, I'm sure at a minimum it'll be like, you know, New Japan talent. And we'll see from there.
No, I think it's good that you're working with international companies. Obviously, Tony Khan has had a good relationship with a lot of different companies. I'm very interested to see, like, because it feels like AAA is now done with Tony Khan, especially with the growing relationship that's evolved with CMLL, New Japan. Obviously,
and AAA, I think, trying hard for WWE's love.
Man, imagine trying to be the redheaded stepchild of WWE. It could not be me.
There's already several of those.
Progress
wrestling. In the family. Shane.
Yes, there are. Moving forward, FTR Bald, a.k.a. Dax Harwood, said on his podcast that FTR has been given several months off by Tony Khan. And considering how they basically carried Ring of Honor over the course of the summer, it's probably a good idea. They worked their tails off in the year of 2022. And being given a little bit of time off is probably a good thing, one, for them, and two, not just for them physically, but also for them as a whole, because at a certain point you get stale and you get kind of like, fans get kind of tired of you, per se. It's one of the benefits of cycling acts in and out. Just look at the response Adam Cole got. Obviously, he was out for 6 months due to a concussion, but a good thing to keep acts coming in and out, because it keeps them fresh, it keeps fans fresh, and you don't get stale. And I think that's a big thing. I'm excited for them, both personally and professionally. Dude, go touch grass for a little bit. Have fun.
Yes. I don't have much to say beyond that. But
all right,
yeah, well, I mean, I think FTR's had a great year. They really killed themselves in that, especially Dax in that match with the Briscoes in December. They deserve some time off.
Yes, they absolutely do. Let's continue on. Couple injury notes. Nick Jackson broke a toe early in the Best of Seven series. Look, had no idea. Good for him for being able to gut it out. Rosario Grillo, I believe I pronounced that right, is having leg and ankle surgery after his injuries on Rampage. He fractured both ankles, tore ligaments in one of them. Woof, what a bad break for him. And then Kyle O'Reilly is still dealing with issues from the aftermath of neck surgery, and we know he had neck fusion surgery this summer. Not shocked that he's dealing with continued issues with that, but it's unfortunate. Hopefully those get cleared up and he can get healthier faster.
You know, neck surgery is always scary. Anything along the spinal column is that's a tough surgery. Hopefully he'll continue recovering and everything will be well with him. I think Rosario is, I think, often the driver for the Young Bucks to and from events. So I recall actually on one of their BTEs I had on in the background that they were talking about how they had to drive for themselves in the snow a couple weeks ago because he tore up his leg on that taping. So I think it was actually a Dark taping rather than Rampage proper, if I recall correctly. But hopefully he gets better soon as well. And that I'm sure that Tony Khan will help him out with the medical bills, but he should morally be doing that.
Yeah, and I'm...
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I'm guessing he is. I believe, Fred, that is it for the news. Now we can get on to talking about these really, really good shows, Dynamite and Rampage. What were your overarching thoughts of the two?
I think there's an argument, and I haven't like sat down and thought about this, haven't done any comparisons side by side or anything, but this could have been the best week of TV in the history of AEW. I thought Rampage was a very good show this week. It wasn't an all-time or anything, but it was like a 6 or 7 out of 10. And I thought that this Dynamite was just absolutely fantastic. It had a couple flaws, which I wrote about in my weekly column, also called The Good, the Bad, and the Hungy on Voices of Wrestling, where I reviewed it. But I thought overall this you know, Dynamite in particular just slapped. I thought it was just fantastic. I can't gush about it enough.
Yeah, Dynamite was tremendous. I unfortunately was not able to watch most of it live. I'm finally better from COVID.
Yeah, so you sound a lot better.
I really do. Oh, Fred, you should go back and watch my YouTube show for Monday night. I had to call
it. Oh, God, I can only imagine.
Fred, it was bad. It was rough. It was probably the worst audio I've ever done. And people still enjoyed it and thought it was good. So I'm like, my brain was so foggy. I was just like, I spent, I think at one point, 10 seconds trying to remember one word. It was rough. But
that sounds like me on every episode.
Yeah, you're not that bad. Let's get to talking about these shows. Listen, this was tremendous. We started off Hangman Page versus John Moxley, and we've continued to see the trend. And obviously they always like to start with a hot opener, but they're not just starting with hot openers recently. They're starting with big openers to try and draw fans in from the lead in. And it worked this week because the rating was, I think, 936,000 with a 0.33 in the demo, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think it was the number three show. Was that right? I didn't put it in the notes because why would I do that? But
I think it was only behind the NBA, which is a big win. NBA on ESPN is a huge draw every single week. Now, what I really liked about this, they just beat the ever-living shit out of each other.
And, oh, this was intense, yeah.
And I think the best part was you get Paige hitting the deadeye and then the Buckshot Lariat for the win. But then Moxley sold a concussion. And I think this is tremendous. One, it builds off of a shoot concussion that Adam Page got. Perfect for the storyline. You're building up another match. Two, Moxley finally gets his damn vacation he's been waiting 4 months for. And three, you get Hangman Page the win, and it continues to build this feud. John Moxley has only been pinned a handful of times. I think this is the sixth time that Moxley has officially been pinned in this company, which is very noteworthy. And you continue to grow this rivalry. No, to my knowledge, Moxley isn't actually hurt, but it all blends in perfectly with story. This is great. Taking an unfortunate situation and building off of it with something storyline wise. This is turning chicken salad into chicken shit.
Way around.
Hey, listen, I had COVID all week. Chicken shit into chicken salad. Yeah.
I thought this was a fantastic match. One of my favorite little things from this match was Paige bringing back the spin cell on a lariat with like they recreated the concussion spot pretty early in the match, and Paige was able to fight back from that. But I thought that was a cool callback. I like this match a lot. I went 4.25 stars on it. I also liked the note of Moxley doing a callback to the Shield days and doing a curb stomp late, calling upon, you know, the Seth Rollins partnership, of course. I just thought this was a great hard-hitting match, and I thought it did a really nice job setting up for another match in the future, possibly at Revolution. But I like this a lot.
It was absolutely tremendous. I gave it 4.25. I don't know if it's going to make my running Dynamite dozen, because there were a couple other match. There's one other match on the show that's already in the top three of my running Dynamite dozen, but this was excellent. And then it led into what we thought was going to be MJF, as Tony Schiavone was in the ring, but then it turned out to be Adam Cole, and he gets a rousing reaction from the Los Angeles crowd, and then delivers a promo, really heartfelt, describing the difficulties he had with his back-to-back concussions and the struggles. And then he finishes it off that it's bad news for the AEW locker room, not for him, that he's back and not going anywhere. Thought his career was over, and he finished it off. Remember this day. This is the day when a new Adam Cole is born. Adam Cole who make a promise. One day, no matter how long it takes, one man will be at the top of his mountain, and his name is Adam Cole, baby. Look, this is a great way to, one, you give the crowd a surprise. Two, you have a loaded show with another memorable moment, which is when you put your best foot forward, this is the kind of stuff you want to do.
Yeah.
And three, I thought it was excellent, an excellent promo by Adam Cole being real. It turned him babyface, which obviously you wanted to do the Elite versus that Adam Cole and Red Dragon, but you can't do that right now for many, many reasons.
Yeah. One of you can't have him as a heel right now. You can't.
And you brought him back. He's a babyface. The fans wanted him back. They love that he's back. And this promo confirmed that he's going to be babyface for quite a while. And I'm very intrigued to see the direction they take with him.
Yeah, and even if it's just for like a couple months, you know, they decide to turn him heel after that. Like, he has to come back as a babyface. He was out too long. It was too serious of an injury, and it was, it's just very self-defeating to try to swim upstream and have him be a heel from day one. Maybe they'll have him turn heel around Revolution. Maybe they'll wait till later in the year. Maybe they just don't have plans for him to be a heel right now, anytime soon. And that's all good. I actually thought this was like the best promo of his AEW career. I thought he came off like a superstar. The crowd loves him. He got a huge pop coming out, got a great response throughout the promo, except for the one guy who decided he had drank enough this early in the show. Like, it was 5:30, man. Like, take it easy. But he's trying to be the Brutus Beefcake fan. If you remember Brutus Beefcake's return to Raw, like on the fifth episode or whatever. This was just a home run of a segment.
And it continued a home run of the show. Jungle Hook, Jungle Boy Jack Perry, and FTW champion Hook versus the Firm's Lee Moriarty, and the greatest name in professional wrestling right now, Big Bill. William Morrissey, also known to most people as Big Kaz. Look, this was fun. This was exactly what it was meant to be. None of these guys are truly tremendous pro wrestlers, at least at this point. There is still a lot of hope for everybody not named Big Bill. And Big Bill's already a tremendous big man and knows exactly how to work as a big man.
Yeah, Big Bill's very good at being Big Bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he knows I
don't need Big Bill dropping, doing drop toe holds and, you know, working on the arm wringer for a 2 minute teeth segment, you know. Like, he knows what he does, and he is very good at it right now. So,
oh yeah, Big Bill is great at being Big Bill, and that's exactly what you wanted here. They teased the T-bone from Hook, and then Hook got the T-bone to a loud reaction, and it was honestly the spot of the match. You had it finished with Jungle Boy getting Lee Moriarty with the snare trap, which is one of my favorite submission holds
in
all of professional wrestling. Look, this is fun, and I know they kept advertising Jungle Hook as one night only. With what the ratings look like in the quarter hours and the minute by minutes, and how well received this team was and how well they worked together, they may have something and might want to continue this. I don't know if that's going to be in their plans, but I think it could be a tremendous way to continue getting Hook on TV, not overexpose him because he's in a tag team with a very capable worker in Jungle Boy. And this tag team division, we've been talking about it for weeks, is pretty thin, especially now that FTR is going to be out for several months with a little bit of a vacation. Like, you're talking about the Acclaim versus the Guns as the program right now. You need fresh blood, and this would be a great way to continue getting fresh blood in there.
I think the Guns and the Acclaimed are a good like pre-pay-per-view, you know, storyline, so I'm okay with that.
But this was a company that was built around tag teams, though. You want to have tag teams in this company that, like, when this company started, there was a lot of tag teams. There were also a lot of trios, too, which is why we now have trios titles. But this is a tag team promotion.
Oh,
and right now, there is not a surplus of tag teams.
I don't know why you're yelling at me. I agree. Yeah, I mean, they could definitely use them. I think that they're perfectly cast for like the Rock and Roll Express style mode where Jungle Boy Jack Perry is the guy that sells a lot, and then Hook is the guy that gets tagged in for the hot tag. And I think the two of them are perfectly complementary for each other. They're a great young babyface team. I think they can have like that Hardys effect, you know, from like the late 90s where they come out and you just hear very high-pitched screams as they make their entrance. I think that they could be very appealing to the to members of the female, you know, women audience, and could be a draw with them in particular. And I think that there's some juice here. I think they should give it a longer run. And it would give them both direction, and I think that's very good for them right now. Also, I want to put over Lee Moriarty in this match. I thought he worked really well here. He was really doing the heavy lifting for the heels in terms of the in-ring, and I thought he worked well with both Hook and Perry, and put together a very solid match. And also, Big Bill needs to be given credit specifically for the big sell, the T-bone suplex by Hook after the Jack Perry missile drop kick, where, you know, the storyline of the match was basically Hook going for that on him and not being able to get him over, but then Hook was finally able to. And Big Bill did a wonderful job of selling that as a big deal. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. I'm very excited to see the trajectory of Lee Moriarty specifically. We know that Tony Khan thinks Jungle Boy is a true pillar of this promotion. And we know that Hook is probably, he's a project, but he might be the most over person in the building week in and week out when he's on TV. Fans just love a Hook, and it's pretty easy to see why. Let's continue on. This was one of my favorite segments of in AEW history. First, MJF comes out after Takeshita and cuts a promo on Takeshita, calling him Takeshita, which is just the low-hanging fruit. And we obviously know the gimmick that MJF is doing. He's doing kind of an anti-AEW gimmick with the pending free agency of 2024, and really leaning into the types that AEW fans don't like, the Cornettes of the world. Mm-hmm. And it's working. It's great. And then Takeshita just speaks to him in clean, perfect English. I'll kick your ass. Yeah. I spoke to Takeshita at an indie event. Dude can speak English. That's not an issue for him. So, but MJF obviously just going for every piece of low-hanging fruit possible. And one of my favorite things was you had MJF pick out Ken Jeong and Freddie Prinze Jr., and we know Prince Jr. was going to start his own wrestling organization. And he ripped on Ken Jeong for the fact that he had a failed sitcom on ABC. And then Freddie Prinze Jr. called the Scooby-Dooby douchebag, which, listen, it may not be very clever or good. I thought it was one of the funniest things MJF has ever said, and I absolutely loved it. But then he gets run out of the ring by Takeshita, and Brian Danielson comes out, and these two kick the living shit out of each other and have a tremendous match.
This match owned.
Oh, it owned. And there's a lot of talk coming out of this match, Fred, and I want your opinion on it. Takeshita doesn't win. He does not win on Dynamite. He does not win on Rampage, and he does not beat any of the big names he faces, despite I don't think he's ever delivered under a 4-star match against any of his opponents, given a big stage. How concerned are you about this?
I'm not. It's a storyline at this point. You know, they're, you know, it's been teased enough with Don Callis showing up at his matches and with him going to his matches over the PWG Bola weekend with a AEW camera crew with him that it's readily apparent. that they're going to set up a storyline. And we already talked about this some, but I have negative concern about this. This is, they're going to do a storyline based around him pairing up with Don Callis and starting to win, and he's going to get pushed, and it's going to be awesome. I just don't, you know, I think once he got signed and once they started having Don Callis show interest in him, it became clear that he was not just going to be a guy who can work fantastic matches and hang with the top stars but lose, but it's apparent that he is going to get pushed to, I would imagine, a decent bit over this coming year. So I think anybody who's concerned about that, I would advise you to just take a chill pill, wait a few months, and see where he is in, let's say, April, because I think he's going to be in a very different position by then.
Yeah, he probably will be, and especially the Don Callis stuff. I think that's probably going to be the catalyst to his push, and I think they're going to be waiting for his push for a little bit. I would not be surprised if we see a Takeshita world title challenge at either Double or Nothing or All Out, as far as continuing to build him up, because he is an AEW guy. He's not a DDT guy anymore. He lives in America. He is an AEW contracted wrestler, and I think they're going to continue to treat him as such. And that is why I think the push is coming. Just overall, like, this show is just kicking so much ass. Then you had Rene Paquette with Juice Robinson. And he challenges Darby Allin for Rampage, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. I'm here to kick ass, take names, and win championships along the way. So Darby Allin, you want to open a challenge? I'm going to challenge you to a match this Friday on Rampage. Let's see if you're as tough as you think you are. My favorite is he just looks at Rene Paquette and is like, "Rock hard." Sorry, what a, I scared my dog.
What a great catchphrase!
Brock Hart is so good, especially considering he's just a Western shitbag, and you could see the Levi patch on the back of his jeans when he wrestles. It's the whole thing's just tremendous. But then you had the Mercedes Moné offer match. AEW Women's World Champion Jamie Hayter and Dr. Britt Baker DMD with Rebel on the outside defeat Saraya and Toni Storm. And this match was good.
Yeah.
I will say, AEW does a great job booking women when it comes to tag team wrestling. They really do. Mm-hmm. They understand how to book tag teams. They understand what's good with their women, and they understand how to make the chemistry work. And I think nobody gets overexposed, which has been a problem with the women's division, not necessarily having a lot of top-end talent. This is the top-end talent in the women's division right now.
They figured it out.
They all performed well. And we continue the story. Obviously, last week, Saraya said that Toni Storm was the best wrestler in the division, picked her literally right in front of Hikaru Shida. So Shida throws the kendo stick to Toni Storm, but it was blatantly in the middle, so Jamie Hayter could grab it. And actually, Britt Baker grabbed it. And then continued their storyline by cheating once again. Mm-hmm. And then Jamie Hayter hit her version of the Rainmaker. I can't remember what she calls it.
The Haterade, I believe.
The Haterade, yes. Oh God, that's tremendous.
Yeah. My wife was watching with me, and she was like, "I love that name." So.
Oh, it's absolutely phenomenal. But it continued multiple stories. Now you have Shida beginning her heel turn. She's obviously going to have to answer for the kendo stick, and we'll see how that turns along. And then Britt Baker cheated again without Jamie Hayter knowing. And now that continues that storyline because Hayter does not want to cheat, and it continues to happen. So we get multiple storylines continue there. And, of course, Rebel just looked hot on the outside, as she always does. That real, real MILF energy from her. Always a fan.
Yeah, I like this match a lot. I thought it was really good. I thought Saraya looked the best she has in ring. Of course, this is, what, her second match, so that's not saying much, but I thought she looked noticeably better than her last outing. And, I mean, the other three women in the ring are, like, three of their, I don't know, top five or six in-ring women workers. You know, this was scripted, you know, put together really well, scripted, however you want to put it. And I thought it was like 3 3/4. Very enjoyable match.
Yeah. Awesome stuff. And then we get the Jericho Appreciation Society coming out and cutting promos. And this was a very weird segment. We had already had announced that Ricky Starks was going to face Jake Hager next week on Dynamite, but he made a challenge to Hager. And Action Andretti looked like an absolute jabron because he's just not there with mic work. Talking when you have guys like Ricky Starks, Chris Jericho, 2.0, Daniel Garcia, all of whom are good to tremendous talkers. And Andretti, he kind of looked like an AI bot with how he was speaking compared to the rest of them. They could have delivered this so much better.
I'll be honest. I thought Action Andretti did better than you're describing it, at least. I'm not going to say like it was a promo of the year contender or anything, but I thought it was a respectable outing for someone who doesn't have much experience with it. I thought his material was kind of weak. I thought it felt very much like a generic 1998 kind of promo that just wasn't good, wasn't particularly great by any stretch, but it wasn't, you know, a disaster at the same time. This was a weird segment, but there was some stuff in it that I liked a lot. Daniel Garcia telling, I forget if it was Starks or Action Andretti at this point, but telling one of them, I remember when I was young like you, would just crack me up a lot. Man, Daniel Garcia is going to be a superstar. It's just a matter of time. There was some good stuff in this, but I felt like this was definitely the weakest segment of their program. So, mm-hmm. You know, not fantastic, but fine.
Yeah, I wish this would have been delivered a whole lot better, but there were good elements, as you said. And then finally, Escalera de la Muerte 2 World Trios Lord. Championship match. I gave this 4 3/4. I saw people throwing around 5 stars, yourself included.
Yep.
I could not go there, but man, was this great. The finish is what really did it for me. Omega delivers a one-winged angel off of a ladder wedged between the ropes and another ladder. So basically an avalanche one-winged angel. And then Pac tries to hit a black arrow. Omega gets his knees up, and then he's able to scurry up the ladders and get the belt. I think what really held it back for me is Omega struggled getting the belt. But this match was filled with tremendous spots. Omega still had the shiner from Wrestle Kingdom. He comes out with the IWGP US title. And I think one of the really fun things about this match was you never would have known, that he had wrestled in Wrestle Kingdom, but let's just, go through some of these spots as, Fred, you just sent this to me.
Yeah. So I've started typing my notes rather than writing them in a notebook. And, when something is particularly crazy, I put it in all caps when I'm typing. And, as you can see, the vast majority of this match was just all caps. There was just too much crazy stuff in this for me to not give it 5 stars. I thought everybody did just fantastic stuff, and I thought it was a really satisfying blow off to this match. You know, Kenny nearly killing himself like minutes into the match by doing a Tope Kanhiro to the floor, going through a table because he missed it. That was wild. You know, Pac countering a one-winged angel with a poison Rana. You know, there's just so much cool stuff in this match. And like, I get this not being a unanimous 5-star match. I totally do, because it wasn't like, I still, you know, for example, the Escalera de Muerte match a few years ago with the Young Bucks and Lucha Bros was much better at the pay-per-view. But this was, I thought, just a fantastic outing and just a blast to watch. And the idea that, you know, on weekly TV, you're getting a card, in particular this card, with these matches where the weakest one is a very good tag match between Jungle Hook and the Firm. And you have this and Danielson and Takeshita, and you have Adam Page and John Moxley all in the same show. You have a really good women's tag match on top of that, too. This is not something that has ever happened in American wrestling history in terms of weekly TV, like this kind of match quality.
It's insane.
This was like not just a pay-per-view quality card, but like a top 50 all-time pay-per-view quality card. And that's me being like conservative with the number. It was just an all-timer. Just how good these matches were. on free TV.
Yeah, it's we're truly blessed, and it's so hard to complain about this company in general. But obviously, our job is to try and critique it for what it is.
And oh, and there's things to critique on this show. You know, one thing we didn't talk about is specifically too much is the Mercedes Monet non-debut, which I thought was a misstep because of one line in a Britt Baker promo a couple weeks ago where, you know, they're setting up this mystery match, mystery partner match, and Britt drops the I'm the boss line, like very intentionally towards the camera while saying it, looking towards the camera while saying it. And it's obvious that, like, this is a hint towards something. And given how AEW's done this style of debut so many times before, where they just hint at it without telling you outright that CM Punk's coming or, you know, all these other names that they've hinted at but just did not outright say we're coming, the surprises. Surprises is the preferred AEW form of debut. They don't do, like, in 3 weeks, Mercedes Monet will appear on AEW Dynamite. They don't do the countdown clock shit. So because of this one line and because they aired it, I think they did set some expectations that it would be Mercedes Monet in this match. Now, they went and they said that Toni Storm was the partner. They filled the slot. But would you have been shocked if the angle was instead Hikaru Shida outright turning heel, beating down Toni Storm backstage? We don't know who Saraya's partner is going to be. Surprise, it's Mercedes Monet. Like, that was, I actually thought that was a very possible thing that could have happened this past Wednesday. And cutting the lights off right after the match, granted with Excalibur, you know, most of the TV audio being Excalibur running down cards, I think that was also a mistake that really set up people to expect Mercedes to come out. And instead, they did the run through for Rampage. You know, I don't think it's going to cause any kind of real lasting damage to the company, but this was a goof. They goofed up, and, you know, that was, to me, a mistake. Minor, but a mistake.
I'm going to counter. I don't care.
That's fair.
And the reason why I don't care is, in segment three on January 4th, Britt Baker drops the boss line. Okay. Obviously, she's planting a seed. Literally, less than an hour later, Saraya names Toni Storm her tag team partner.
Yeah.
Now, this to me tells me two things. One, they thought they might have had a deal in place to get her, but then I think that they realized quickly that they didn't. But they also, my guess is they have a deal for her to come in at some point. I believe the Bushiroad contract is her first match back in the United States outside of WWE is going to be the Battle in the Valley in San Jose on February 18th. And I think the way that contract is structured, they don't want her wrestling before then. That is probably my guess. Why would they? They got to sign her first because the way the contract was done with WWE is she could
negotiate with New Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. She can negotiate with New Japan and Bushiroad, but she cannot negotiate elsewhere. Well, if you debut her on the 11th, that kind of raises some red flags, yada, yada, bing, bang. Plus, Bushiroad's going to want that first match. Yes. They're paying her an exorbitant amount of money, something they've never done with a female talent before. Obviously, Bushiroad is relatively new to women's wrestling, having just bought Stardom within the past few years. But it's very noteworthy that they're paying Mercedes Monet this kind of money. Two, they literally told you in the same show that she wasn't coming. Like, I think we're extrapolating too much. Well, now you mentioned the CM Punk stuff. They announced the first dance, and then later on in the show, Darby Allin lays all those little hints that he's coming. But they announced the show and then did it. Like, I think it's a completely different situation. I think they still think Monet is coming. It's a one-time thing, and they literally covered it up later. So I think we're overreacting to one little line. At least at this point,
here's why it's the circumstances that make a mistake. If this past week they were in Topeka and there wasn't a mystery partner match, none of this would have mattered. But the fact that they did the hint, they dropped the Sasha Banks line a week before a show with a mystery partner, and yes, it was filled, but, you know, we've also, wrestling is littered with examples of partners being announced and then some angle happening. and then it being in Los Angeles. This wasn't Lexington, Kentucky. This wasn't Charleston, West Virginia. This wasn't Roanoke, Virginia, as I go through second-tier towns in my head. Ann Arbor, Michigan. It wasn't these places. It's just the fact, you know, the circumstances of it being a major market, like a super-duper big market near where Mercedes would likely be hanging out or even living these days, with the hint and the mystery partner slot, I think it was just a little too cute for their own good. Again, I don't think it caused any real damage to AEW. It's not like we're going to see their ratings drop off by a quarter next week or anything. But it just was not, it wasn't the best idea, and they could have handled it better. And I don't think that they're going to, like, there's going to be tons of Sasha stans who are going to angrily renounce AEW and never tune in again. But I just think it was a little too cute for their own good.
Yeah, but the Sasha stans hated AEW before.
What's well, now they'll like it because she's coming in.
Yeah. Well, you know, but that's my thing. Like, I don't think angering the Sasha stans is really a big issue because they hated AEW already. The second she steps into this company, they're going to be all aboard the AEW train. And as long as she's treated well with the booking, we're not going to have any issues. I just think we're overreacting to two words when they corrected it within the same show, telling you that the direction wasn't going to be Mercedes Moné for the January 11th tag match in LA. We're over extrapolating here. Now, if they continue to lay any other hints and she never shows,
well, that's a different matter. I'm just saying for this one week, it was a mistake. If she had done that promo this coming week, would have been fine. If they had not had some mystery partner match, would have been fine. If they weren't a week out from Los Angeles, would have been fine. But all those things together, I think, makes it just not the smartest idea they had.
It could have been done better. Yeah.
No. Well, that's a different matter.
The reason that they had it is because they thought they had her in. From my perspective, they thought they had the deal in place, and they thought that they were going to be able to bring her in. The second they weren't, they announced the mystery partner. They didn't lead any speculation to Moné until January 4th, and then on January 4th, they still corrected it. Like, I just think it's we're trying to make excuses, and we're trying to place blame. I just don't think there's anything there.
We're going in circles on this one. So you want to move on to Rampage?
Yeah, let's move on to Rampage. This show kicked ass.
It was a very good Rampage.
We've made fun of Rampage a lot. Darby Allin versus Rock Hard Juice Robinson. That's just going to be my thing. I just love saying Rock Hard. It's just fun.
It is.
Odie's like, what the hell are you doing, Dad? Sorry, buddy. But no, this was a very good match. A lot of back and forth. I loved the Avalanche Destino Scorpion death drop gimmick that Darby
Allin used. That was a fantastic setup. Yeah.
Oh, he used to set up the, whatchamacallit, the coffin drop and 1, 2, 3. Awesome. Awesome match. Look, I don't know what Juice Robinson is going to be for AEW, but I think there's some meat on the bone with him.
Yeah.
And this is a great way to start. Obviously, Sting comes out and celebrates with Darby Allin, and that ends up being the match. But this is a really good 4-star match to start the show.
I went 3 3/4, but I like this a lot. There's one move in this match that I really like just because I like seeing people bust it out, and Juice did a really good stomach buster in this, and that's not a move you really see all that much of these days. It feels like more of a 1980s NWA, you know, Jim Crockett.
Juice box is something that
the juice box
he's been doing for quite a while. I'm gonna be honest, I'm surprised Excalibur didn't mention that it was called the juice box, because that's a tremendous name.
It is a good name. But yeah, I mean, I just always like to see a stomach buster, and it's cool that it's part of his moveset. But yeah, like this good stuff.
No, I agree completely. And then Renee Paquette introduced The Acclaimed had a nice little line about the Saudis. And then as they're about to put their hands in the cement, but it was silicone, to put on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, they get interrupted by the Gun Club. And they pants the guns and push their asses into the mold. And it's just another perfect way that to cement that they are the ass boys. I thought this was, was it needed? No. Was it fun? Absolutely.
Yeah, it was a little segment. It was fun. People were into it. They did a good job of editing around the botch of the entrance by Caster that apparently happened live. You would have had no idea just watching this. And but yeah, it was totally fine.
Yeah. Look, it's Rampage. You want to get the Acclaimed out in front of the fans. This is an easy way to do it. Kings of the Black Throne, Brody King and Malakai Black with Julia Hart and Buddy Matthews versus Eddie Kingston and Ortiz.
Not with Buddy Matthews and Julia Hart at first. That was actually a big part of the match.
No, that was a big part of the match. And Eddie just kept ignoring Ortiz. And towards the end of the match, Buddy tries to come in with the chair. Eddie steps on it, ends up picking up the chair, turns around, and Julia Hart's standing right there, and Ortiz accuses him of wanting to hit a woman, and then they go back and forth. Malakai Black hits Black Mass on Eddie Kingston.
After Ortiz ducks it.
Yep. And bada bing, bada boom. After the match, Malakai Black told Ortiz, "You did good," kind of teasing some stuff. Look, I don't know where this Eddie Kingston Ortiz stuff is going, but I hope it gets there fast because I'm already sick of it.
Yeah, this was just a fine match. It was not bad by any stretch. I gave it 3 stars, but I thought there is a lot. It could have been a lot better without all the storytelling in it. But you know, they're doing a story. I still don't like the underlying storyline of this, that Eddie Kingston and Ortiz have been friends for years and years, but it's all been shaken to the core because the House of Black did a spooky video. Doesn't resonate with me. It feels very dumb. I'm just going to say it. It's got a dumb basis, and we'll see where it goes from here. It makes Eddie Kingston seem like an absolute idiot, which is never good to portray one of your characters as just that dumb. I don't like this.
Yeah, I don't like it either. But it seems that we're about done with it, which is good. And then Renee Paquette interviewed Golden Globe Award winner Paul Walter Hauser. I have no idea who this guy is, but he won a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor. But what was really cool is this guy, you could tell, loves professional wrestling. He delivered a pretty good promo in the ring. And then when Jeff Jarrett, Jay Lethal, Satnam Singh, and Sanjay Dutt come in, he rips Jeff Jarrett for looking like a woman in charge of Crunch Fitness. And then rips on him for telling him, "Hey, this isn't Memphis." Like, you could tell this guy loved wrestling.
Yeah.
Makes fun of him for the guitar. And like, "You bring this guitar out every week and you never play it." And then Jeff Jarrett hits him over the head with the guitar, which you just know this wrestling fan wanted to happen. And then out comes Orange Cassidy and the Best Friends to make the save because Danhausen was already in the ring. Look, you can make fun of all these lower level celebrities coming in here and doing stuff. This was fun, and you could tell that this guy loved wrestling, and to me, if you want to keep doing that kind of stuff, I'm all for it.
Yeah, this was a fun segment. I thought that Hauser did pretty well, and I thought, one thing I particularly enjoyed in this was just Satnam Singh just trapping Danhausen in the corner to neutralize him for the guitar shot. That just the visual, like this massive man trapping relatively small Danhausen with his head sticking out around him, that, you know, it's kind of funny. But I thought this was a solid segment. And there, you know, Jay Lethal despicably stole the Golden Globe afterwards. And I think they're going to continue the storyline. And I don't think we've seen the last of Mr. Hauser.
My guess is we haven't seen the last of him either, which I'm to be honest, I'm fine with it. If a diehard wrestling fan being here sounds great to me. Then lastly, we had the main event, Street Fight, Ruby Soho and Willow Nightingale versus TJS. This kicked ass. These women beat the living shit out of each other. They used barbed wire. They used tacks. They used tables. They used cement as a Willow Nightingale went for a powerbomb on Anna Jay. Anna Jay completely missed the table. Willow broke it with her ass, and Anna Jay just lands on the concrete. Look,
that's
Oh, what a brutal bump. But let me tell you, these women worked hard. They busted their ass. They wanted this to be great. And you know what? It was. It was brutal. There was reason behind the violence, and it worked within story. I gave this 4 stars. This was awesome. This is exactly what you want from these people, because
yeah.
Willow has a lot of potential, but she's got kind of that Bailey-esque babyface vibe. Ruby Soho is very up and down, but overall above average. And Anna Jay and Ty Mello are, they're a mixed bag, but they all worked incredibly hard and it paid off. It even had my puppy Odie enthralled as he's just sitting there watching these women beat the crap out of each other. It was great. When you get my dog watching wrestling, that's very impressive.
Yeah, I just really liked this match a lot. They just beat the hell out of each other. It was wild. It was really enjoyable, I thought. Just the table spot alone was crazy, but I really liked the finish with Ty and Ruby working together in the ring for the blow off, and I thought they had a really nice sequence once the thumbtacks came out, and it was just a wild match. Ruby's blade job was ridiculous.
Muda scale, good.
Oh, it was like a 0.7 out of 1 on the Muda scale, I think. Just hell of a, just a lot of blood. Just a lot of blood. As soon as she started bleeding, there's just like drops on the mat on the outside. It's like, oh boy, we're not fooling around, are we?
No. This was really good.
Yeah.
Even the botch. The botch powerbomb spot from Willow, which that table is set up in.
It looked like a good move. It just looked like death, you know? Like, yeah. That's not how you want to take a bump. I hope she's okay. I assume she is, since I haven't heard anything on, like, Twitter. But that's just a hell of a bump to take, man.
That is an accidental botch that ends up actually being better, because...
Assuming she's not hurt. But yes, yeah. I fully agree.
100%, I'm glad you threw that caveat. We don't want anybody actually being hurt.
The whole idea is to make it look like it hurts. And, you know, when you do matches like this, you know, there's a little more lenience. You know, you're obviously working in a way that is going to hurt some. You know, same with, like, these chop matches where you just lay into each other. But, you know, it's still, the idea is to not injure someone. And hopefully I assume everyone's walking away from this, since this was taped earlier this week. And there hasn't been any news of any injuries. I do enjoy that Mark Henry just has to get in his catchphrase before the main event. No promo this week, but my God, we're going to hear that it's time for the main event. Especially,
hey, you know what?
I have to read this. He said, "Well, it looks like these women are about to get violent." Just crack me up. God bless Mark Henry.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? They're giving him a bunch of money. You might as well get every dime you can out of
it. Hell yeah.
This was overall a really good show, but I thought what was the most noteworthy was at the end, Ruby Soho, after really blowing off Willow Nightingale the first couple times that they
not wanting to partner with her, but like, I need a partner,
gave her the fist bump, like the sign of acknowledgement, like, and respect. And I think that's going to be important as time goes on in this company, because little things like that matter. Willow has made a friend and an ally, and that's going to be really important as she continues to ascend the ladder here in All Elite Wrestling. But Fred, I think that's going to do it for our show today. We do have a couple matches already announced for Dynamite. Jake Hager versus Ricky Starks and Bandido versus Brian Danielson.
That one's going to be great.
We had one more match announced at the end of Rampage. I don't know if you caught this. The Young Bucks versus Top Flight.
I did miss that. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I hope Top Flight wins and you get Top Flight and AR Fox versus
that'd be good.
The Elite for the Trios titles. And that, to me, is a pay-per-view quality match. Just, hey, go open the show, do stupid shit for 20 minutes. Hello.
Wrestling, you're great. We do get to see if Jake Hager will, in fact, slap the face off of Ricky Starks' face.
I hope Ricky Starks steals the hat and wears it around like a title belt.
I think they're going to have a very entertaining match. I don't think it's going to be great by any stretch, but, you know, you get 3 stars out of this, you know, and have some fun along the way, that's okay. But yeah, this was a great week of wrestling. I hope next week can even be close to it. This is like a once in a lifetime streak of television right here this past week. But just a blast, total blast.
No, 100% total blast. And with that, that is our show. You can find us on Twitter at GoodBadHungy. You can find me on Twitter at TheRealForno. And at
you got anything to plug, Tyler? I'm gonna ruin the promo. But you got anything to plug?
Well, I'm doing that right now.
Yeah, but you writing anything new? Any new articles?
Oh, I'm writing stuff every day. We're recording this Saturday morning, and I've already put up, I think, 8 different things for the Vikings Wire. A lot of what I do is kind of like I take like little bits, aggregate them, and add my own personal spin to it. So it's not like, hey, it's not like you're just reading something that just somebody just that eats and then takes a shit. I try to add like my own touch to it, my own analysis, which with football is a little bit easier to do than other forms of aggregation. And then I also have all my NFL draft stuff coming out. I already have finalized scouting reports on 17 total players. Nice. It's 14 wide receivers and 3 cornerbacks. It's a Vikings focus. So I'm doing positions first that the Vikings need and are going to prioritize likely in the draft. So
all outright asking, weren't you on something with the New York Post this week?
Yes.
This is what I was trying to set up for you. And you're just sandbagging me here. Hardcore Holly.
Listen, this was a few days ago, but yeah, it was really cool. The New York Post and SNY, which is like a New York City specific version of ESPN. They invited me on to do like a little 6-minute video spot talking about the Vikings and Giants game. They invited me to do before the Christmas Eve matchup as well. And you can't see it because we're not doing video for this show, but the hair, the guy Brandon loves the hair and the fact that I kind of look like a real Viking. So that was pretty cool. But I guess I'm getting popular and famous in the sports community, which is never a bad thing.
There we go. Trying to get your plug in and you're just like, just stomp it all over it, man. Come on.
Listen, I try to be modest and I don't try to brag too much.
Got to get your ass public. Over.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, make sure that if you like what you hear, make sure you subscribe to our personal podcast feed, The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy. We appreciate everybody who's listening on the Voice of Wrestling feed, but in order to continue to help us grow, subscribing to our single feed is going to be the best way to do so, and also by throwing us a 5-star rating and giving us a positive review.
Tell your friends.
Absolutely.
I do hope you enjoy the show, and if you let your friends know, you know, word of mouth is the best way to spread a word about something. So
yeah, have you heard that Jackass Tyler with Fred talk about AEW? It's a good show.
I do want to plug one thing for myself this coming week. I am finishing up my look at cage match ratings to see who had the best in-ring year according to math, an attempt to do that. I'm finishing that up, and that should be out probably by Tuesday, I think, if everything goes well, maybe Wednesday. On voicesofwrestling.com.
Speaking of Voices of Wrestling, match of the year ballots are coming. I've already come out. The voting will be finalized on the 22nd, something that I still need to submit, but I've been so busy with Viking stuff that I have not been able to do so yet. Make sure you check that out. Now we're gonna go through the whole plugs again. So
yeah, do it.
I don't care if you're here twice. I ain't editing it out because I'm lazy. You can follow us on Twitter at GoodBadHungy. You can follow me on Twitter at TheRealForno. You can also follow me at The Vikings Wire, where all of my football content comes out. You can follow Fred at Fraglant Wrestling, and that is Ted Turner's Wrestling, not Vince's Wrestling. And then you can also follow all of our written work for Voice of Wrestling at voicesofwrestling.com. Please give us a 5-star rating and review. And please, if you are listening on the Voice of Wrestling podcast feed, to go find our feed, The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy, and subscribe there so we can help continue to grow the show.
Patreon. Meantime, I've started a Patreon, Flagrant Wrestling, starting to write there. Going to get some stuff up this week.
Mm-hmm. You can find that in the show notes as well. And then if you like Vikings football or football in general, we're going to start the Real Forno Show Monday night, 6 p.m. on the Climbing the Pocket YouTube channel. It's littered all over my Twitter feed. So you can go ahead and follow me there and you can see all my stuff. If you love the NFL draft, we're going to transition to doing Mock Draft Mondays and talking nothing but prospects. it's going to have a Vikings focus, but even if you don't love the Vikings, you can listen and still have a lot of fun. And we are interactive with the comments. Other than that, enjoy a weekend of playoff football. We will be back on Thursdays. Will be our new drop time, because we are going to try to stay even more current for you in terms of All Elite Wrestling. In the meantime, have yourself a great weekend and Skol Vikings.
Have a good one.
Music. It's not just part of our daily lives. It's part of our wrestling fandom as well. And it has been for decades. That's where this show comes in. Music of the Mat, the podcast devoted exclusively to the music of pro wrestling, hosted by Andrew Rich. Hey, that's me. Each episode delivers a different topic with a variety of great guests, fun conversations, musical analysis, and of course, a heartfelt pun or two. New episodes drop every other Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. Check out Music of the Mat only on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.